All right, welcome back. Welcome back from the refreshment. And I hope that everyone is refreshed from it. All righty, so just a quick introduction. Dr. Emmanuel's wife is being here with us. And she's Emma, she's at the back. Wave to her or say hi to her later on, yep. Well, welcome, and I'm glad that you're here with us. Okay, so the time is back to Dr. Emmanuel.
Back to me.
Yep.
Ah, she's enjoying the rest. Were there any questions?
Do you want to share?
Sorry?
Do you want to share?
Oh, no. I thought you said do you want to share. I said, I've been sharing for the last 2 hours. Where have you been? Oh, no, sure, yeah. No, I'm fine. It's going to be best if I stand, I think. So no questions. We're going to start to look at Second Temple Jerusalem, which was the stage for much of of what takes place in the Gospels. Look at various areas. Much of the says beforehand. Much of the reconstruction of Second Temple Jerusalem it's very difficult. But much of the reconstruction we gain from two sources. One of those is of course Josephus, and the other is in the Mishnah, which gives us a picture of what it actually looked like. It's very difficult to reconstruct Jerusalem, what it looked like 2,000 years ago, because so much has been built up upon the same area. So in order to perform an archaeological excavation of areas, you have to tear someone's house down or weaken it by digging tunnels underneath their houses, and that's generally frowned upon. But we do find quite often, like when they're doing excavations to build like a children's park or something like that, it's quite often they'll come across tombs, or they'll come across buildings, they'll come across houses from the first century, but much of this is accidental. So it's very difficult to know what it actually looked like, but I think the reconstructions that we'll be seeing here are relatively accurate, not relatively accurate, but pretty good. Considering we're 2,000 years away. This is one depiction of it, what it looks like, again from Josephus. There's a mention of this kind of a walkway which goes onto the Mount of Olives, but there's no, I don't think we have any evidence actually of that being there. We'll look at all the different parts of the city individually. As we go along, we've got the Kidron Valley, the Hinnom Valley over there, and a lot of this was the new city, but we'll look at those in a moment. But keep your mind, if you can, on that kind of rough picture, that rough outline, to see how it all everything fits together. So with the topography, we've got the walls, this is the temple, talk about in a second. And if you draw a line straight down here, you'll have where it's called the City of David. And you'll see a better image of that in a moment. But that's the City of David. And then you've got approximately Hezekiah's wall, which the Hashmoneans rebuilt. Why build a new wall if you've got the foundations there? So they extended Jerusalem up to here. And then you have what's called the Second Wall, which was Herod's wall. This one here. Herod the Great, we think, built it, but we're not 100% sure. Now, this becomes important. We know it was up around the time of Herod the Great, because Jesus would have been crucified probably around about there, at that point there. Now, I'm mentioning that now, and I'll mention it again a couple times, because there's this issue concerning the record, gospel record, of being crucified outside the city. But later on, people say, well, it's inside the city, because today it's inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is part of the inside the old city. But you have to understand that walls were being built constantly, and at the time Jesus was crucified, he was actually outside of the city walls there. We then have this third wall, which was never finished. This was the one that Herod Agrippa Herod Agrippa began to build, set the foundations and the markings for it, but he stopped building because it looked like he was trying to overthrow the Roman Empire. But this wall was again reinforced and built up a bit more during the times of the first revolt. After the Jews had driven away the first wave of Roman soldiers, whilst Rome was consolidating itself, they rebuilt this wall and they doubled down inside this area of Jerusalem before they were ultimately destroyed and taken down. The reason why they had to build this was really because of an increased population during peace times, relative peace times. But also what we had is, and this is the way in which cities grow, you don't just kind of wake up in the morning and say, let's build a big wall, it makes make Jerusalem bigger by building a big wall, and then people come and live there. What happened was that people were beginning, they knew Jerusalem was very important, so they began to build their own small houses and stuff along the along the edges, and then at a particular time, a wall is made to encompass all of it. So there would have been some kind of temporary dwellings. Think as well of the major feasts that took place in Israel. The Regalim with Passover, the Feast of Weeks and Sukkot. Jerusalem would have had thousands more people coming in to celebrate, and they need somewhere to live. They have to stay somewhere. There was obviously areas around here where Jesus used to stay, but some people would camp around here also as well. So it needs kind of like a temporary expansion area for individuals to stay. Josephus in Wars mentions this. I was going to get you the long description, but then I thought probably it put you to sleep, so I didn't do it. Wasn't properly completed, and there are some excavations in parts of Jerusalem today where archaeologists think they have actually located parts of this wall, but it's not, at least in the time which I've seen it, it was not conclusive. Short section, it's actually a longer section where it says, and it was Agrippa who surrounded the parts added to the old city with this wall, which had been all naked before. For as the city grew more populous, it gradually crept beyond its old limits, which is talking about this one here. There's a long description of it goes here, then it turns right, and then it goes down, and then it does this, but I don't want to bother you with that type of detail. This is a model, the model of Jerusalem that was created. It was originally made in constructed in a hotel out in the west part of Jerusalem, but they moved it since to the Jerusalem, to the museum. And this is a fairly good depiction, according to Josephus, according to secondary sources, of what Jerusalem looked like during the days of Jesus. That is fantastic. That's banned in my classrooms because people fall asleep. But in this, but in a church context, I think it's quite suitable. I think that makes things much clearer. It's actually an excellent model of everything. This area here is called the Lower City, and you can see that the houses are small and they are squished together. And this is, this is like the people here. It's kind of like Manhattan, where you have it's a very prime piece of real estate, and so all the apartments in Manhattan are really squished together. But they're very expensive, and so you still have to have a bit of money and a bit of pull to actually live there. But everything is squashed together, and it was certainly the poorer part of the city of Jerusalem. During the revolt, the zealots occupied this area of Jerusalem, and you see they were opposing the upper area here. But it was the zealots that had this particular point here. Let me just make a note of saying this was the old city of David, right here. He never built the temple. Obviously, Solomon did, but that's also the size of Jerusalem during the days of Ezra and Nehemiah on their return. So it wasn't particularly big at all. So we've got the lower city right there. This was settled in quite early, so this was developed first. So it is older and much smaller, and the city kind of expanded out this way and out into the back there. Here you would have had mainly lower middle class people occupying this area. I'm saying lower and middle class because you can't stay there easily. Jesus never comes, he doesn't stay here. He has to stay over on the Mount of Olives in places like Beit Ani, the house of the poor, which it's called. And he stayed in these cheaper accommodations on the other side of the hill. This area as well, we know, attracted a diaspora community. We believe attracted a diaspora community, and there would have been a few synagogues around at this time in this location. You've got the upper city up here. You can see that the houses are bigger, much bigger. We've got these wonderful kind of orange slaty type roofs. We've got the amphitheater, this was the place where the priests, Sadducees, and the richer people would have stayed. Much higher, easier access to the temple, higher up, more at a level with the temple. So it's established high up on a hill. There would have been, the aristocrats would have been dealt with, would have been living in this particular area here, and it would have been much closer to Herod's palace, which would have been over at this place here. This is today's Jaffa Gate. That could run you into the town there. Note the theater I'd mentioned. We have Josephus mentions a theater, a hippodrome, and a gymnasium, I believe, in Jerusalem. Today we have no evidence of such a thing. There's no physical evidence, because in order to get to it, we'd have to tear up Jerusalem and dispossess so many people of their lands just to find out what is underneath. And is that worth it? Well, it might be, but many people don't think so. There is the people who lived up here definitely had a religious connection. They would have been associated more. We spoke about the Sadducees. They would have been associated with the temple function. They would have been able to share in its riches. The temple itself, let me just say now, even we're not talking about it strictly now, by way of introduction, the temple typically from the days, after the Persian Empire, has been a money pot. There has been money, there is gold hoarded in the temple, and it was known as being a very rich institution, very rich. We find Jesus mentioning there was an expression about swearing about the temple, it's nothing. But the gold in the temple, and now your oath is binding. There was a great deal of money that was held in this temple. You've got to think that the temple tax, the two denarii or whatever it was that people paid, everyone was coming every year and putting that money into the temple. Irrespective of the repairs that would have been needed to be done, there was money being hoarded in that place. And we find throughout Josephus, throughout history, procurators, rulers, they go and they try, and some succeed, to plunder the temple, to take money, to go down there and extract money. There was a heck of a lot going on, and the temple, the place which is supposed to be a place of religious worship, becomes a place, a money-making venture. Does that sound familiar to any of you at all today? Mention that in passing. The burnt house in Jerusalem, where we went down in that region, is here. And we find, I didn't bring slides of that, But there are many, many rooms you see in the burnt house. You will see lots of mosaiced floors. You will see lots of expensive pottery. You see a lot of stoneware, stone jars. And the place screams of a high level of affluence for the people that live there. And all of that is up in this area here. And this area here, even today, if I'm not mistaken, is mainly the Jewish quarter. Over here, there's a gate that leads in, and this gate was called the Essene Gate. The Essene Gate. Now that was a place where, there's a possibility that this would have been a place where there would have been an enclave of some sort of Essenes. Now we mentioned last week that there could have been a connection between the Essenes and the Herodians, due to this prophecy that Menachem gave to Herod the Great that he would be king. And if so, it could kind of make sense that maybe there was a small area where Essenes collected, but that's purely speculation. The new city of Jerusalem was going to be all of this here, sparsely populated most of the time. I imagine it would have filled up during during the feasts. We're going to talk about these two pools in just a moment. Pilgrim occupation, that's the guess. This is a relatively large area of land, and this area here would have been filled, would have had dotted around it a number of gardens and tombs. And it would have been this, somewhere in this area here, where we would have had the burial of Jesus, because you know it was quite, if he was crucified here, it would have been relatively nearby where he was actually buried. We read the record in John. Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden, a new tomb, which no one had yet been laid. And that says in the place where he was crucified, if he was crucified here, then the tombs would have been relatively close by. It wouldn't have been like, you know, you would have crucified him and schlepped him, you know, 20 miles up north or anything like that. It would have been quite close. And this is the site today of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, if you get a chance to go. This is that area there. If we look at it from this direction, it's this here. I've got another picture of that as well. This is an entrance into the city. It's all reconstructed, but you have this kind of like stone type quarry area here, and this would have been the site of the crucifixion. And you've got to note where it is. It is a place where people going in and out of the city would have seen. The whole idea of crucifixion was an advertisement by the Romans saying, if you do any crimes going into this city, this is going to happen to you. If you a runaway slave, this is going to happen to you, and you get your crime stuck above your head. So it's in a very public place where loads of people would have seen, and it was just like almost as an advertisement, both for negative things, but obviously also for Christianity's purposes too. And this is just a close-up, another view of it from a slightly different model. This area here, this area here, is still kind of accessible. We didn't actually go there. It's by Stephen's Gate, the Sheep Pool Gate, which is just around about here, still around today. Now there is in Jerusalem by the Sheep Gate a pool in Aramaic called Bethesda, which has five roof colonnades, which is this particular place here. Let's not think about the five too much right now. In these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there, he knew that he had already been there a long time, and he said to him, "Do you want to be healed?" And it was at this place where it was a pool of water, and they would wait for an angel to stir the water. It would move, and whoever jumped in first would be healed of their infirmity. At least that was the tradition. But this was the area right here. And again, we've got not just this pool here, but we've got a number of other pools around Jerusalem, which you have to think are so important for a decent water supply. Synagogues in Jerusalem. Numerous, but unknown. Rabbinic sources speak of there being synagogues. Josephus speaks of being hundreds of synagogues within Jerusalem, but we don't have evidence of that many. The New Testament attests to synagogues in Jerusalem. And I said, Lord, they themselves know that in one synagogue after another, I imprisoned and beat those who believed in you. Closeness between Jews and followers of the way. This is my point. That shouldn't be on. That's not part of the scripture, by the way. This text here, that was my mistake. This text here, though, shows a closeness between Jews and followers of the way. Paul goes into synagogues, places where Jews did what they did and met, in order to find out, to find believers, and to find Christians in order to persecute them. And this should give us an idea of the landscape of the early church, where it's not, we would kind of think like it would be a situation where we would have churches and synagogues. But it wasn't like that at all. It would have been, all these people would have been seen kind of like as Jews together, and some of them would have been followers of one particular rabbi who claimed to be the Messiah, who died and rose again, who was Jesus. And so Paul has to go to synagogues to find these people. And I place them often in all the synagogues and try to make them blaspheme. This is Paul again going looking for believers in the synagogues, individuals in the synagogues at this particular time. So in any event, we've got a nice attestation of the New Testament of synagogues in Jerusalem. We don't know anything about their physical description. We are pretty sure that they were not the elaborate buildings that you see today. The synagogue is a phenomenon that has developed quite considerably during the years. We don't know. We guess that they would have been like houses, large houses. And we're going to take a look at some evidence of some of the things that happened inside them in just a moment. But the synagogues were a place where Jews and believers met. We find Jesus teaching and preaching in a synagogue, for Pete's sakes. So it is there is a strong connection between the two. And I'm saying that because, and emphasizing that because there's kind of a belief, we have this belief with the Gentile church, that the two entities are separate and always have been, and that Jesus was the first Christian, and everything just separated off from there. But it wasn't quite as clear a picture as that in the first century. We have evidence, some evidence, of a synagogue in Jerusalem, external evidence, other than biblical. We're now dealing into hypothesis and ideas and cute ideas working together. But we see this notion of in Acts, the mention of the synagogue of the freedmen, as it was called, and of the Cyrenians and of the Alexandrians and those from Cilicia and Asia rose up. So this picture, this tells us, or gives us a clue, that there would have been different synagogues for different nations and peoples around. So in this sense, at least, we have an idea that the synagogue served as a guest house for people. Why? Because if you're traveling in from someplace in Asia, you're Jewish, you speak one language, you come to Jerusalem, you want somewhere to stay, you can stay in a synagogue. So it wasn't just this religious place necessarily, but it would have been a place where people gathered, it would have been a place where people lodged even if you were associated with it. But the synagogue, some people like to kind of make a speculation, and this is one of those things where there's no proof at all, that the synagogue of the freedmen, that this is the sign for the synagogue of the freedmen, as it was called. This was an inscription that was actually discovered in Jerusalem. And this is the point of each community having their own synagogue. This is what they call the Theodosius inscription from the first century. And we're going to look at the inscription in a moment, but it tells us some of the things that happened within a synagogue at the time, the Theodosius inscription. Very important inscription, written in Greek, by the way, which speaks something of its international character. So we have Theodotus, son of Vetenus, priest and synagogue leader, son of a synagogue leader. Interesting. Grandson of a synagogue leader. That's like he's saying, you know, David Emmanuel, son of a pastor, grandson of a pastor, so I've got that in my lineage. Rebuilt the synagogue for the reading of the law and the teaching of the commandments and the hostelry, rooms and baths for the lodging of those who have need from abroad. It was established by his forefathers, the elders and Simonites. I don't know who the Simonites are, but we have in this, it's an important inscription because it's found in Jerusalem, obviously speaking of a synagogue in Jerusalem, but it tells us what was going on inside a synagogue or what the synagogues were used for. It suggests that synagogue leaders were hereditary, but it suggests that these things happened. There was teaching, lodging, and there was a mikvaot for baths. That's how they functioned at that time. What about communal prayer? There's no mention of communal prayer at this time in the synagogue. It has been long suspected by a number of scholars that prayer was not something that took place in a first century synagogue, even though it does take place now, and that was a slightly later development. For the most part, many scholars believe that the synagogue was a place for gathering. People would come together like a community center, they would sit down, they would teach and expound the law and Torah and discuss law together. That's what they would come come down together to do. That's obviously as well, that's the basis of the Pharisaic development of Judaism, where in many contexts, they would argue that study was the highest form of worship. Study is the highest form of worship. And you ask, well, how can that be? And their idea was, I'm talking about rabbinic, which was later, so I don't know if they're just looking back at this period romantically. But when you study, the more you study, the more you learn, the more you learn, the more you do. And so you end up living more of a life of worship because you've studied so darn hard. Many schools of thought understood that study was a form of worship, as well as matters such as prayer. Industrial activity in Jerusalem, what went on? What goes on in this place? These are slides which I used in school. I was bored, okay? So I was like, you know, I do this to keep myself entertained as well. There were goldsmiths there working in the temple. They had to maintain bits and pieces, articles of gold, utensils for that were being used, the trimmings in the temple and all of this. There would have been a set of goldsmiths working there for sure. There would have been stone cutters too, a huge amount of stone cutters. First of all, there's all kinds of, if you go to Jerusalem and that in the Judea, there are rocks everywhere, but there must have been stone cutters for Herod's building projects. These would have been skilled artisans. When you see, we'll see the temple that's been built together, the stone was cut, it's still there today, and the masonry is still fantastic. It's still very impressive. As well as stoneware vessels, one of the only independent characteristics of Jewish pottery and vessels for drinking and for cooking and everything else, one of the only characteristics that identifies something as being Jewish is the fact that it was made from stone. Stone was one of the was a material that was seen as being kosher because, unlike pottery, it didn't actually soak up anything. So it was seen as being pure. And you see a lot of the fine stoneware, the remains of that, even in some of the artifacts found in Jerusalem, found in the burnt house where we all got to visit last year. But that's another story. Olive production is another huge industry that took place around Jerusalem. You obviously have the Mount of Olives. When you go to the Mount of Olives today, you don't see everything. But that back in the first century, there would have been just the whole mountain would be covered with olive trees. Olive trees and olive groves. Many of them were taken down to make way for a lot of the graves which they have there now. But there still are a number of them. Whenever we see a name like Gethsemane, the word that's a Hebrew word we keep speaking about, well, I keep speaking about the Hebrew background. Even though we read this word Gethsemane, there's clearly a Semitic word underneath that. There's a Hebrew word under that. I would say Hebrew more so than Aramaic because of that E ending. Another story, but we have gat, which means a press, a gut, and then you would have shemen, which means oil or fat. So you've got the press of oil. And once you have a place named like that, you know that it's related to the production of olive oil. But there are a number of places, and you'll see whenever you read the Bible now and you see a word that has gat in it, like the town of Gath, the Philistine town, then you know that it's to do with the production of oil. So oil production was another huge industry that went on there as well. Now, concerning management, we have this entity in Jerusalem as well called the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin. A political organization. The question is, was it purely political? There is a, if you go through all of the records, go through Josephus, you go through New Testament records, you go through, I don't know, Herodotus, you go through all of the historical records, there's kind of a conflicting understanding as to the Sanhedrin's primary role. Was it a purely political body, as Josephus seems to indicate, a body that dealt with the government, a government type or government-related body, or was it a religious body, as we see more in rabbinic literature? Or maybe two things can be true, and there was a bit of both in this particular setup. In the Hellenistic, the Greco-Roman world, they knew of an organization, a political body of advisors called Synedrion. Now the Synedrion, it echoes, it kind of parallels what's going on, but we always have to be very careful, because if you see a name of something in one culture, you can't automatically plug it in to a different culture thinking it's exactly the same thing. There may be an understanding, a relationship between the way in which the groups work, but I'm going to imagine as well that there would be a twist, and somehow that group, if it is the same thing, would have been adapted to the Israelite situation. So there you've got a political body of advisors. In we know, and this speaks towards how they function as a group. We know that Hyrcanus, this is Hyrcanus II, he invokes a Sanhedrin against Herod. So it seems to be something that a situation arises. There aren't permanent positions and permanent people. A situation arises, so you call these people together. You know, they may have different jobs. You're calling one guy from the temple, you're calling one guy from somewhere else, you're calling one guy from somewhere else to come together. So he invokes one against Herod. Herod invokes a Sanhedrin against his sons, Aristobulus and Alexander, when he wants to put them to death. He wants to kill them, so he gains a Sanhedrin to begin that trial process. There's one invoked by the high priest against Jesus. It's time to convict him, get Sanhedrin together. I don't know all the practicalities of it, but it would have been people you would have called on at a particular time. They come together to make these judgments. In Acts 5 as well, there's one gathered against Peter and James. And in Acts 7, against Stephen. And it kind of looks like it's almost a vindictive body where you want to get rid of somebody legally. So you get the people together, the Sanhedrin together, and you make your accusation. And they kind of try the case to see what goes on. So from this, we can kind of gain that it's a non-independent body. Which is to say, it's not like a sect or anything like that, but it is a group together. There would have been priests, there would have been members of the aristocracy, and there would have been Pharisees as well. So you would have had members from different sects come together to try and decide something. And I think, I'll leave that alone. And it would have been a body that was brought together for convictions. If somebody committed a crime, invoke your Sanhedrin. They come together and they decide. So I'm going to guess that they would have tried to make it, you know, as balanced as possible so that whatever decision was finally made was stuck to and agreed to. So that's basically Jerusalem. It's kind of like political religious makeup and what it actually looked like. And that brings us onwards to talk about the temple. Now, I've got two sections left. So we're probably going to do half the temple now, finish the temple and do the teaching, if you have enough strength left over. And then we can call it a day. Let me just check here. Looking for a suitable place to stop. Okay, we should be fine. So let's start looking at the temple, at least for the next another few minutes. This you've seen before, probably my best picture of Jerusalem, and that there is the temple, lower city, and everything else there. Notice the elevated location of the temple. It is high up, it would have been high up and visible. It's on a mount, on Mount Moriah, however you want to address it. So it is on an elevated location. This is the old city of David here, and this is what we call the Kidron Valley. Josephus had kind of a walkway going over to there, to the Mount of Olives, which would be on this particular side. The lower city we've mentioned and discussed, as well as the upper city, and this here is the Valley of Hinnom, the Hinnom Valley. Now the Hinnom Valley was the place where they used to burn rubbish, and it was a place which had a reputation. This was the place where in the book of Kings, it speaks of King Manasseh sacrificing his children, where they would commit the sons, pass your son through the fire, as it's called. But it was child sacrifice that took place there, and by the first century, it turns into a dump where rubbish is burned, where garbage is burned. And so it was obviously quite hot in this place, and this place comes to be known as Gehenna, from Ge, meaning a valley, Ben Hinnom. Ge Ben Hinnom is translated into Greek as Gehenna, which comes meaning, which comes to mean hell, because it was so hot. This is hell, physically, what it was like. So you can only imagine what it must have been like during those days. It must have been really, really hot, because it gets incredibly hot in the summer in Jerusalem anyway. And plus you've got the burning that takes place there, so it would have, it gains that reputation for being really ridiculous. That's the Essene Gate that I had mentioned before. And this is the Temple Mount. We've seen this. We want to see, talk about a couple more things in the detail. Herod's temple, though it began in the year 19 BC, it wasn't really finished until 64 AD. So by the time Jesus was alive, they were still doing some work on this temple, which makes it all the more horrible when it's being established and before it's even finished, Jesus is saying, this is all coming down really soon. So we can see up here, Fortress of Antonia, we're going to see that. That was built by Herod as well to help police and manage what takes place on the Temple Mount. The what I'd mentioned last week too is the number of temples that were actually built. So you would have had the original Solomonic Temple, which is going to be technically the first temple on this area with the stone, and this is in rabbinic tradition, this was the first stone that was used to create the world. That's where it all began, that's rabbinic tradition. And also the place where Abraham sacrificed Isaac. So Solomon's temple is built first. That's destroyed in 567 BC. And then Ezra comes back and they recreate something around about on this platform. So technically speaking, in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, that is the second temple. Because it would have been smaller, but it would, the exiles would have put something together to maintain the worship of the God of Israel. After that, it would have been, there would have been repairs, it may have been developed a bit more, but then you would have had the Hashemites come, not the Hashemites, the Seleucids come with Antiochus IV. He would have desecrated and destroyed some of this this temple, and it was rebuilt and recreated during the Hashemian rule. So that technically would have been the third temple. Then after that with the Romans, Herod the Great the Hashemian era, you can see this extension here, as well as work for the temple. Then Herod the Great comes and he pretty much destroys much of the Hashemian temple. And we know that because the record of Josephus states that Herod the Great had to find priests who were masons, who were able to reconstruct the inner parts of the temple because they had to be kosher, it had to all be legitimate. So Herod the Great recreates that. So it's not the second temple, it's not the third temple. We're looking at the fourth temple or fifth temple that Herod the Great actually builds, and that is only has enough time to actually be built before it comes down. Good. This is a nice picture again of the model. We can see this is all of this is the compound that Herod built. And if you go today, we did this, not today, if you go down to Jerusalem and you look at the side of this wall here, you'll be able to see that there is a bend from where the original temple goes and it moves outwards when the and you can actually see the Hashemian extension which bends outwards as does Herod the Great. So you can still see evidence of the around about here of the extension that Herod the Great put on. This, so was that a question? No, yes, no. This area here is, on the temple compound, is the court of the Gentiles. Like I said, If Israel worships a God, an international God, a God of all peoples, there has to be a place where these international peoples can come and worship Him. And this is where it was. You would come up the temple. If you can see a couple of steps just there, that's the southern wall. You'd go into an archway, walk up some steps, and you'd come out onto the compound here. All of this was the court, called the court of the Gentiles. And that's where Jesus had a couple of issues. And we see that they end up selling, exchanging money. People wanting to buy temple shekels. People wanting to buy turtle doves. People wanting to buy all of these things. That's where they were doing it. Part of the place where there was supposed to be worship for the Gentiles, for the God-fearers, and everybody else to come in. But notice, and I know this, we're not doing literary stuff too much here, but notice a literary change between the book of Matthew and Mark. Matthew says, Jesus said to them, it's written, "My house shall be called a house of prayer, but you make it a den of robbers." That's what Matthew says. Matthew's concern, obviously, is very much for is Israel. It's a very kind of a Jewish book. But Mark's rendition is it not written, "My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations"? So we see a bit of a twist put on it right there, where the emphasis, Mark obviously has a more global view, but the emphasis is on all nations, which I think is more appropriate in this case, because the sellers, the money sellers, were hindering the worship of all of these nations from coming together in Jerusalem. This act of Jesus coming into the temple, and it gets worse because John has him with a whip, turning things over. This would have been more of a symbolic act, because I don't think Jesus went and had all of the money changers and got rid of absolutely all of them and they never came back again, but it would have been something that would have caused a bit of an uproar. And I say it's a symbolic act as well, because it reflects what Judas Maccabee had done years previously, when he had come to the temple to cleanse it of the Greeks that were there. After Antiochus IV had profaned the temple, he comes in, Judas Maccabee, with palm branches and people saying, "Hosanna, Hosanna, Hosanna," and he comes in and he drives out the remaining Greeks from the temple, and they rebuild it and they sanctify it once again. And Jesus comes in a very, very similar means, in a similar way. And when Jesus comes in with cries of "Hosanna, Hosanna" into Jerusalem, and he comes up and he begins to do that here, this is what I mean, that people's minds is, who did this before and what happened? Well, it was the Hashmoneans. The Hashmoneans came in and did this. Is Jesus going to be doing the same thing again? Is he going to overthrow the government again? Are we going to get our country back, our city back, and our temple back again? That's the process in which they are thinking of, which is all connected into their history. Matthew and Mark, I'm sure, know this very, very well. But 2,000 years later, I think we don't quite see the significance of what Jesus is doing, the model which he is following, the pattern which he is following, and also the tension which that would potentially create within the city of Jerusalem. The leaders would have seen this. They'd have been thinking, "Oh my goodness, oh my goodness. If he comes, if there's an uproar, the Romans come down, we lose this temple, we lose our money, we have got to get rid of this guy. He has become a threat to us all." So the connection is very strong, and it's still there. So we have here Solomon's colonnade. I think it's coming up to 5. I don't want to go too far. Let me stop after this one here. This is the place, Solomon's colonnade. You can just about make up a couple of entrances here from the ground. Those would have been the places where you come up into the temple compound. And these here, which would have been really nice and cool, all around the temple, you've got these pillared areas. And this was a place where in the temple you would have had rabbis coming with their disciples to sit down and to teach their disciples on this nice shaded area. So that's a place when we find it, when we find Jesus going to the temple to learn, when we find him as a young child and he's left at the temple asking questions and trying to learn from the rabbis, which is another, I'm calling the rabbis a bit anachronistic, but it's another issue here. But we find that this is where it would have been. That's where it really would have taken place. And it's at this place, we see the mention in John. Jesus was walking in the temple in the colonnade of Solomon, around about here. So the Jews gathered around him and said, "How long will you keep us in suspense? If you're the Messiah, tell us plainly." And this is in a very, very dangerous place, because it is so it's so like charged with all that's gone, with all that has gone before, with the history of the area. And it's only in the places that we find Jesus would make his most explicit statement of being the Messiah, which is a loaded term, is actually in Samaria, when he's speaking to that woman saying, "I am he." And that's more of a safe environment. He makes those claims here, and it could set off a powder keg way too quickly, so we don't find him confessing straight away. So it's 5 o'clock. Let's take a break. Let's breathe. Switch on the lights. We all need a break here. I certainly do. And we can come back, and I'll try and finish off the temple and talk a little bit about Jesus' teaching as well to close us off.